on business and labor, and the first thing I'd like to announce is House Bill 2838 will be carried over. Do we have a specific date?
Do you want to do it for Wednesday, Mr. Chair? Do you want to move it?
We have time on Wednesday?
Yes, we should be able to.
Then it will be carried over until Wednesday. I mistakenly told some people that there would be no hearing today, thinking I was correct. I was wrong, and they're not here. So I do not want to have a hearing without them in the room after I mistakenly told them it would be Wednesday. I just don't think that would be right. So if anybody's here just for that, you may go back to breakfast if you wish. All right, I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 3374.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3374 limits the ability of insurers to terminate the appointment of insurance producers who have acted as a producer under an agency appointment for at least 10 years, and the producer is either a captive agent or has entered into a non-competition agreement in the agency appointment with the insurer. You have in front of you, members, a -1 amendment, which modifies the definition of a captive agent to include that the insurance producer is obligated under the contract to steer all qualifying business to the primary insurer.
We have some nice people here that represent Kennemer has shared with me. I'd like to call Representative Kennemer, obviously, and Jerry Rothenfletch. And then on deck will be George Starr, Keith Massingill, and Gary Oliver. The gentlemen, sit down and tell us what you know about this.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Representative Bill Kennemer, appreciate the committee taking time to hear House Bill 3374. It's interesting, in my time here at the legislature, I've been involved some in insurance agents issues. A lot of that is Jerry Rothenfletch, who's sitting next to me, a friend and a partner who's worked on some bills. Last time I passed Senate Bill 429 in 89, which allowed that agents could only be terminated with a reason. This bill is taking on a very special group of agents. They're called captive agents. Captive agents are people who only work for one company, and when they're terminated, they're paid their 5% commission for 1 year on 90 days' notice, and that's the end of it. Even though you're going to hear some pretty interesting testimony, like George Starr, who worked for 37 and a half years, and he can't contact a single one of those people for a year, and his total remuneration for all of that loyalty and all of that support and for a quality record is his commission for 1 year. We think that there's a little change in balancing that needs to be done. There was a slight drafting error in the original bill, and you'll notice that you have -1 amendments. Those -1 amendments make sure that this bill only relates to captive agents and make sure that independent agents are not included. I think the best way to explain the reasons for this bill is, frankly, to hear from four agents who have been personally affected by the insurance company policies. And to be very straightforward, there are quite a host of others who would love to testify. But I think it's fair to say, out of fear of retaliation, they're not going to be present today. We've also submitted copies of several letters of support, and hopefully you've been getting some emails and other correspondence. I would like to turn it over to Jerry, and I urge your support for the bill. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Jerry. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Would it be possible that I could ask two gentlemen to come?
Well, I will call George Starr, Mr. Massingill, and Mr. Oliver up shortly. Is that who you're referring to?
Well, two of them, but that's okay. We can do it with a...
Great. Thank
you. You run the show.
Okay. Yes, sir, I do. Thank you.
My name is Jerry Rothenfletch, and I reside in Clackamas, Oregon. I am here to testify in favor of House Bill 3374. I am a recently retired independent insurance agent. I own and manage my agency. I have 46 years of insurance experience. I am the president of the Consumers and Agents Action Committee, which I started in February of 1988. This organization was established to provide information, opinion, and research to agents and consumers on matters important to the insurance buying public. The CAAC membership includes consumers, independent, and captive insurance agents in Oregon. Several months ago, I was asked to reconsider further legislation to support a just cause termination bill for captive agents. I say reconsider because the CAAC in 1989 co-sponsored Senate Bill 429, resulting in ORS 744.081. We had hoped Senate Bill 429 would prevent the unfair and reckless termination of good insurance agents in Oregon. Unfortunately, it did not. Oregon is an at-will employment state, and ORS 744.081 only prescribes that an agent or producer's appointment can be terminated with 90 days' notice and merely given a reason. There is no just cause language protecting a law-abiding agent who has spent years building up his or her insurance agency. In our research of Oregon statutes relating to agent termination, we find no language that says an insurer must have just cause to terminate a captive agent if they are otherwise acting lawfully. I believe some insurance companies with captive agency structures like to act as though their agents are employees. Their agents are, in fact, independent contractors who pay all of their business expenses, including the hiring and supervision of their employees. They are not employees. Captive agents work hard to build their agencies through personal solicitation and good service. Their clients see them as their agent and stay with them because they value the service provided. These unique personnel and rewarding later relationships should be protected so those consumers can keep their trusted advisors as long as they choose. I believe HB 3374 is a fair and just bill whose time has come. I urge you to pass it and stop the reckless and mean-spirited actions of some insurance companies against their agents. At a time of increased unemployment in Oregon, I urge you to keep our captive agents and their employees both working and motivated to service their clients in our good state. Thank you for your attention to this important legislation.
There is any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Ruffin Flesh? Thank you, sir. It's good to see you again. As I said, George Starr, Keith Massengill, and Gary Oliver. Whoever wants to go first, please go ahead.
Go ahead, George. To bring these copies, do I
give them? Hand it to Tasman over there. Tamsin, forgive me. Whoever wants to go first.
I'll go first. Good morning, Mr. Chair and other members of the House Committee. My name is George Starr. I was a farmer's agent. March 23rd, 1972, at age 24, I became a captive insurance agent for Farmers Insurance. March 10th of 2009, at age 61, I became a terminated captive Farmers Insurance agent. When hired, I signed a contract with Farmers in the presence of my district manager, George Osco, and division agency manager, Ed Lodmill. In this contract, certain provisions were glossed over for the focus on do not lie, cheat, or steal, and you'll have a great career. District Manager George Osco also promised I give it 5 to 10 good hard years, and you can set back semi-retire and service your clients, take care of your walk-in trade. You have a base by which to make a living off of. For years, this remained the model. An agent not only developed loyal clientele, but also became part of a farmer's family. Then in the late 80s, it all changed. Farmers, a stock company, sold to a British American Tobacco, known as Battus. Ironic that a national insurance leader in the promotion of non-smoking, for example, non-smoking auto discounts, home discounts, life insurance discounts, is owned by a tobacco conglomerate. This is only the beginning of many changes. Throughout these times, right up to the present, Farmers Insurance declares all agents are independent contractors, while behind closed doors, agents' contracts are violated, programs engineered to violate independent contractor status, and agents threatened with termination and or terminated using the most ambiguous logic known to man. And I use as an exhibit on the agent's contract, Exhibit A, which is where I was terminated, and it says, apparently, I did not service in all policyholders of the companies in such a manner as to advance the interest of policyholders, the agents, and the companies. And that's the basis for termination. According to Farmers Insurance, my termination is validated by that underlined reference, servicing all policyholders of the companies in such a manner as to advance the interest of policyholders, the agents, and the companies. Farmers Insurance Agent Appointment Agreement, AAA, provides the agent upon his or her termination notice. The agent has a right to a termination review board. On that same Exhibit A, page 2, the last sentence on paragraph D, I requested this termination review board, and my meeting was held January 13, 2009. I only bring this up because of the indifference Farmers has shown me for over 36 years of dedicated service. The AAA provides that I be notified promptly of the results of my TRB, Termination Review Board. A certified letter was sent to me March 11, 2009, and reached me March 14, 2009, informing me the termination was upheld, but no mention of the voting count. This apparently constituted prompt notification. I'll remind you, I was terminated March 10th of 2009. So this is written to me the day after. With a one-year non-compete provision in our AAA, life becomes very difficult if a captive agent wants to become an independent agent. Independent companies, for example, Safeco, Travelers, Hartford, etc., are not looking to appoint an agent without a book of business. As per our agreement, AAA agreement, Farmers Insurance Group requires that the agent sell their clientele back to the company at a price far below the market value. It's not impossible, but starting over at age 61 is not very appealing. Age discrimination is not a viable venue due to we are independent contractors. There are many farmers agents being subjected to these circumstances in Oregon and throughout our nation. In my second exhibit at B, you'll see it's an article from Boonsville, Arkansas, that have three agents, all of over 55 years, all with the company at least 20-plus years, terminated for no just cause. Give the company the best years of your life, only be rewarded with termination for no just cause. I did not lie, cheat, or steal, and I was profitable for the company most of my agency years. Still, I was terminated. There is nothing in legislative power that can help me now, but Farmers has only started to shred their longtime agency force. One last request. Given House Bill 3374 becomes law, please give it some meaningful enforcement tools. In approximately, I thought it was 2000, but I guess it was 1989, Senate Bill 429 became ORS 744-081. An insurer must give a reason for agent termination. Farmers Insurance violated this law in February of 2000 and subsequently fined by $1,000 by the Department of Insurance. This apparently is a maximum fine allowed for this offense. Can you imagine the fear farmers felt by being fined $1,000? September 5th, 2008, I was given my 90-day notice of termination without cause, Exhibit C. I countered by contacting the Department of Insurance, Dale White and Cliff Nolan, to enforce ORS 744-081. Farmers refused to comply with the Department of Insurance and only changed their minds, granting a new 90 days with a stated reason after I spent $2,000 of my own money to get your laws enforced by my attorney. I find this appalling that I must spend my money to enforce your legislation. My termination date became March 10, 2009. This is my story and this is why I'm here. Respectfully, George Starr. Not 37 and a half years, 36 years, 352 days.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, George. I apologize. I thought it was 37 and a half, just short of 37 then. Now, as a captive agent, then, you don't represent any other insurance companies?
Yes, we can.
You can.
Our contract states that we can write business with another company.
But?
If farmers will not write the business.
Okay.
So, but in this room right here, everybody's insurance can probably be written by every insurance company, meaning that it's a very common thing. Like if I can't go to a State Farm, I can't go to a Safeco for auto, or I can't do any of that. So.
But my point is that when you're terminated,
These
people that you've been working with in farmers, and I guess maybe even some of them go back 36 years, you can't contact them for a year to switch them to anybody else. So you've spent 37 years building a clientele that you cannot move anywhere for at least a year.
The contract states that I cannot solicit directly or indirectly any clientele that I had or that was in my district, which includes all of Salem, basically.
Uh-huh. Now, what kind of malfeasance is involved in your being dismissed? I mean, you've lied, cheated, stolen? What have you
done? I did just want my district manager when I was hired. I gave it more than 5 or 10 years, and then I sat back, and I didn't want to write. I'd rather keep the clientele I have than to go out and beat the brush for a new clientele and ignore the present-day client. Now, you can do both, but I'm going to be very honest. After 36 years, I didn't want to do both. I don't want to continue putting in 12-hour, 14-hour days.
And did you sign a contract that said this could happen?
That they could terminate me for no reason?
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently, but that's not what was explained to me, and as I said in my testimony, the main focus was don't lie, cheat, or steal. And if you asked about, well, what does this mean? Now, the reason for my termination to me is still, after 36 years, ambiguous. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they can jump from servicing policyholders to terminating an agent when, as an agent, that's all you have. That's all you really have to give to the public, the insurance buying public, is your service.
Mr. Chair, just a couple more, and I'm sorry, but I just think this is kind of a new topic for a lot of people. And about how many clients do you have on the farmers?
None now.
Well, smart aleck, that's not the right answer. How many did you have?
Oh, I had about 1,200.
About 1,200 people that you had developed across 37 years of work.
Right.
And now you can't talk to those people about any business matter for at least a year. And they're just automatically in your goodwill built up in your service and your record of profitability are irrelevant in maintaining those people. I guess my point is, I'm really trying to make the point, is this bill is about adjusting the balance. It's not changing the world, but it seems to me when you have a relationship for a long time and you haven't done any of the bad actor kinds of stuff, to have your continuing goodwill and your income dramatically changed for without cause is not a reasonable way to proceed. Two other things, Mr. Chair, if I could. Tamison has a handout from the National United Farmers Agents Association in support of the bill, and also some common questions and answers that I've asked recirculated. And we can continue. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. And before we carry on, there's just two things I want to say. Mr. Starr, I don't know what happened in your case. I've heard your side, and I believe you believe that in all your heart you've been unjustly treated, and I believe you. I believe you believe that. I also believe that you signed a contract, and I'm going to find out if that contract was in any way, shape, or form breached against the current law we have today. And I guess my question would be for you and any other proponent on this bill, is if you want to be dismissed for just cause, even outside of your contract, as a labor advocate, I would be all for changing the statute, saying that employees cannot, may not, shall not, will be dismissed without just cause. But in Oregon, you work at will. Now, if we want to say that every single employee, including independent contractors, cannot be dismissed without just cause, that would be an interesting bill That would be an interesting fight, and that would be an interesting way to look at it and go. And I'd be quite frank with you, I'd be interested in that. But I just wanted to throw my thoughts out there. And, sir, go right ahead. And,
okay.
And we're going to finish the panel, and then we're going to open it up. I gave Representative Kenemer a lot of leeway there. He's one of the chief sponsors of the bill. I also heard one side of the story signed on the bill, and I'm going to listen to other sides as well. So, and then we'll open it up to questions. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, well, first of all, good morning, and I want to apologize if you hear some of the same terminology. I haven't heard any of these people's testimony before, so you're going to hear some of the same stuff because
that's quite all right,
we were all told the same thing. So I've been asked to testify today on behalf of hundreds of captive farmers insurance.
Well, sir, you have to identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Keith Massengill. And I have been asked to testify today on behalf of hundreds of captive farmers insurance agents who are quite frankly afraid of retaliation from this company if they were to speak out publicly. Again, I'm Keith Massengill. I have been a captive agent with Farmers Insurance for 34 years. My father retired from Farmers Insurance some 20 years before this. So as you can see, Farmers Insurance has been part of my family my entire life. And it truly pains me to have to testify about the reprehensible tactics that this company has resorted to in the past few years. Personally, I've been one of the company's top producers for many years, and I have never been threatened with termination. I should say up until today. But I have seen letters to many other agents that have threatened termination, and I do know of others that have been terminated without just cause. When we became agents with this company, we were all promised that if we were to work hard and we don't lie, cheat, or steal, that we will have a business that will provide us financial security well into our retirement years. Our contract specifically states, and I can quote directly from the contract, quote, nothing contained herein is intended to be construed to create a relationship of employer and employee. The agent is an independent contractor for all purposes, unquote. We do not have a retirement plan with this company. Our agencies are our retirement plan. Please understand that the contract that we have as captive agents is one of equity. It is not a contract of service. Our agencies develop renewal commissions that have real value if only we were able to sell them on the open market. We are each like a franchise in almost every way. If it were not for the single issue of a fee being charged, we would fall under the Oregon Franchise Act, where there is an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Franchisees cannot be terminated without just cause. But we are not a franchise. So every captive agent that operates in the state of Oregon has a termination provision that does not require cause. In addition, every captive agent's appointment contains a non-compete clause that deprives them of the ability to contact any of their clients if a termination occurs. The companies will tell you that this bill is unnecessary and that they do not terminate without cause, but this is not true. I have personal knowledge of recent cases where agents have been terminated without cause. They will also tell you that they have methods in place that will prevent an unjust termination, and it's called a termination review board. What they will not tell you is that these review boards are non-binding. I know of one board member personally that told me just before going into a hearing on an agent termination that his opinion really does not matter, and the company will proceed regardless of the outcome. You may wonder why any agent would sign such a contract. Well, when I started as a new agent, Farmers was a family-oriented business that took care of their clients, employees, and their agents. But that did change when the company was purchased by British American Tobacco and later sold to Zurich Financial Services. The agency force was not just an avenue for sales. They started becoming a revenue source. Agents are expected to purchase everything from stationery to advertising through the company. For many years, we even had to lease our computer equipment from the company in order to access our own clients' information. And finally, now it has progressed into taking of agencies through terminations and assigning these agencies to new agents at a greatly reduced commission schedule. So what are we talking about here? Some of the older agents have chosen not to actively pursue the selling of newly introduced financial products that Farmers and other similar companies like State Farm, Allstate, Nationwide, American Family, they all want to market. As independent agents, we have the freedom to decide how to build and maintain our agencies with or without financial products. It is my opinion that the companies see these agents as dead wood, and they began to threaten termination for unacceptable business results. These threats are now becoming a reality, and after termination occurs, farmers will then again assign these to new agents at reduced commission schedules, and these new agents have burdensome quotas to produce those financial products, and if they don't, they will also be terminated. Termination and reassignments are now beginning to happen, and that is why this protection, the bill that this protection provides, is needed. Does this bill prevent a company from getting rid of bad agents? Absolutely not. They have a 10-year window to determine if a new agent will be an active asset to their organization. 10 years. And after that, they will still be able to terminate under the provisions of the Oregon statute. Older agents who run profitable property and casualty agency are positive assets that bring great value to their companies and to the consumers of Oregon. In fact, captive agents in the state of Oregon produce over 50% of the insurance buying public. These consumers have chosen their representatives for good reasons, and they should not be deprived of long-time trusted family agents, just as those agents should not be deprived of their livelihood. Thank you for your support.
Go ahead, sir. Identify yourself, please, before you start.
My name is Gary Oliver. I was an insurance agent. Excuse me if I have, I got sinus problems on my voice.
You're doing great.
I was an insurance agent under contract with Farmers Insurance Group for 27 years. In the beginning, Farmers was a reciprocal exchange, which basically means that policyholders owned the company. Then they were converted to a stock company, then purchased by British American Tobacco, and finally merged with Zurich Group, where British American Tobacco was rumored to own 45% of the new Zurich Farmers Insurance Group combination. I mention this because Zurich is not under the jurisdiction of the SEC, as it is a European corporation. My contract was terminated by Farmers effective December 13, 2004 for policy losses, when in fact only 18 of 29 agents in my district grew policies in 2003. In fact, I had a net gain of 4 policies between January 2003 and July 2004, according to my records. This was during a period where Farmers Management had taken Farmers from the third largest property and casualty insurance company in the United States to nearly out of the top 10 in only a few short years. During my years with Farmers, I had earned the prestigious Toppers Club Award on 2 different years, and I had been awarded the underwriting profitability contract bonus many times. In December of 2003, I had an annual meeting with my district manager, Jeff Johnny, and everything was rosy. Life was good. In January 2004, I was called into my district manager's office again and told, in fairly certain terms, as I recall, that Farmers Management was required to show a certain percentage increase in per-agent new business production for 2004, or Farmers Management positions would be terminated by Zurich, including his own. Jeff told me that his district production was this, if his district production was the same in 2004 as it had been in 2003, then in order to get his required production per agent increase, he would have to terminate 3 agents in his district effective prior to the end of 2004. Farmers would then divide the total new business production of the district by 3 fewer agents in order to falsify an increase. In other words, management would use the new business production for 11 and a half months of the terminated agents in their total district new business production, but would divide the total district new business production by 3 fewer agents in order to get an inflated new business production per agent number that would satisfy management. I remember Jeff Johnny saying that this same routine would be taking place in other farmers' districts as necessary to show the required increased production levels. I also remember Johnny stating that if I, Gary Stewart, and Robert Joy, the other 2 agents scheduled for termination, increased their production by 300%, that our contracts may not be cut. Effective December 13, 2004, I and Agent Gary Stewart under another 25-year-plus agent who was age 62 and planned to retire in just two more years. Both had our contracts terminated via the same 90-day form letter. The third agent, Robert Joy, was still there but operating under the DARG program where his production levels were monitored daily. I mention their names here because they are on the papers I was given by Jeff Johnny in our January 2004 meeting, one page being attached to this testimony. The bottom line, as I understood from Jeff Johnny, is that Farmers was terminating agents in order to falsify an increase in same-store sales, possibly resulting in the puffing up of Zurich stock. But you don't need to take my word alone for any of this. Just look at the 2004 district results for Jeff Johnny and see if the 2004 new business sales for Gary Oliver and Gary Stewart were included into the annual totals, and if that annual new business sales amount was averaged out using two fewer agents. And that is the end of my testimony. However, I would like to make one clarification on one of the subjects that you guys were talking about here just a few minutes ago. Although the contract states that you can't compete with Farmers under the contract and contact your agent, your customers for one year, I have a written memorandum from them stating that you cannot keep a list of your customers, period. Therefore, you cannot contact your customers ever in the future because you wouldn't know who they were.
Thank you. Representative Kinnaman.
Gary, you have that letter, a copy of that letter that you could make available in due course, maybe not today.
Oh, I have it here. I can give it to you after.
Thank you.
Actually, sir, I would appreciate if you give a copy to the committee administrator, and she'll make sure.
Now, which letter are we talking about?
I don't know.
Well, I thought that last one about that you can't keep a list.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I have it with me.
But anything submitted to this committee will go right straight through this committee administrator, Jansen, and make copies, and we'll all get it. I appreciate that. Any further questions of these gentlemen?
See if there's some others. I want to make a couple comments, and then I'll hush
Anyone
up. These are the people I've asked to come and speak.
Mr. Starr, thank you all, gentlemen, for being here today and testifying. Mr. Starr, in your handout on Exhibit A, page 2, there's at the bottom a contract value.
Yes.
And
there's actually four pages to that contract.
Okay, and so we don't have those other two pages.
No, you don't have
four
it,
pages.
I can get it for you if you'd like.
A couple of the ingredients that are on that page you already mentioned was 1,200 clients, 37 years. What was your contract value? Do you know what your contract value is?
Yes.
Buyout?
But at the time of termination? Yes, it was about $85,000.
Follow up. Any further questions for these gentlemen? Representative Kinnaman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I want to thank the four of you for coming today. I guess, first of all, I'd say to the committee, this isn't typically the kind of bill I introduce because it has to do with contract language. And on the other hand, I guess I think that part of what we are here to do is to deal with problems and exceptions. And I guess the story that you hear here is principally about one company, but there are others who I think have not been acting in good faith. And as has been presented here, over these years, this company has morphed so that the contract that these gentlemen signed many years ago, in one sense of the word, has gone through different commitments of faith or lack thereof by differing companies still bearing the same name. So my point is that the teeter-totter, the scale, has been changing in the balance, and that's why I think these brave folks are here to talk about it. I guess a couple of things. One is, and it's sort of interesting to me, that in an insurance agency, your equity is your retirement benefit, and that's the way these were sold. And yet, when it turns out, you get 90 days notice, 1 year's worth of commission, and you're out the door. I also think that there's another piece of this, and that's about bad actors, and I talked about morphing. The other thing is that it is to the company's advantage to get rid of senior agents, because when they take your practice away from you, which is your retirement equity, and they give you only 1 year for it, they place it with another agent, and they place it at a substantially reduced rate, 40 to 60% less than they were paying the current agent. So now the company is getting a 40 to 60% premium increase on the commission. It's not the full rate, but the commission. In other words, that's sheer profit now that's going directly into their coffers. So the incentive is to displace senior people who have worked in good faith for a company for a long time. And I'm sorry, but the words I like to use are outrageous, and I don't use those words real often. But I just think there's a deep concern here, and I think it's a matter of balance. For those who are good players, I don't think there's an issue. But for those who don't, This is very concerning, and that's why I brought this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you. And before you gentlemen go, you know, if there's any illegalities here, we do have a court system, and you're right, you have to spend money, your own money sometimes, to get justice in this country. That's true for everyone, not just you. And that may seem unfortunate, but there's so many words here going around, good faith and morphed. You know, they don't have any legal standing. A good faith is in the statute, but it's still a matter of interpretation. We have a partial contract before us. I look forward to seeing the whole contract. But if you have physical evidence of being threatened to be terminated, I think you may have a good suit right there. And there's a bunch of lawyers in the building. I suggest you go find one. And if you do have physical evidence of being threatened to be terminated, I would like that to ensure that with this entire committee. Or if you feel, If you point blank, you are told by Farmers Insurance, we are going to terminate you because of testifying before this committee, I can assure you, we'll be right back here with this bill, and it will become law, because that's just unacceptable. That all being said, and one thing about this business is I learned, it was a learning curve, and I signed on the bill because I heard one side of the story. Now I'm going to hear the other side here in a moment. But I guess the question is, and I want this to the business people to answer this too. But if we're going to allow for just, right now it's at will, and you even have a contract. It isn't even at will. You have a contract here before you that you're working under. But if it's at will now, and we want to allow for just cause for you guys, just the captive, why not the independent too? And if the captive and the independent insurance agents, why not all independent contractors? And if captive and independent insurance agents and all independent contractors, why not all employees be fired for just cause only and not be working at will? Because if we give it to you guys, I really feel we have to give it to everyone. And if we're not going to give it to, if we're not going to give it to everyone, I have trouble giving it just to you guys. And if you want to respond to my comments, and then we're moving on. Or you can go sit down. It's as you wish. Yes, sir.
I think what you need to understand, and I go back to my testimony on the franchise situation, if it were not for the fee, we would be a franchise under Oregon law. A franchise develops a value. Our agencies have developed extreme value, an annual renewal commission that comes in year after year after year. It's not right. Take, for instance, let's just say you had a McDonald's, and they said, you've done a great job for 30 years. You have a heck of a restaurant going here. You know what? What'd you make last year? We're going to give you that amount of money, and we're going to take your restaurant away from you. That's exactly what they're doing to us. If you took away the non-compete clause, we wouldn't even get the 1 year. They would say, we want your business. Feel free. Open a restaurant across the street. But we want the one you've built up for 30 years. That's the difference. This is not a contract for a service. This is a contract that has equity.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
I also want to point out
we're moving on after these responses. Yes, sir, go ahead.
I also want to point out that in the captive agent, you had mentioned why not independent agents and that type of thing. Well, an independent agent still owns the policy. Let's say, for instance, Safeco, and I have an independent agency in Safeco. So that's all Farmers did to me was take my appointment. They didn't take my license. They took my appointment. And so now if Safeco comes along, if I had an appointment with Safeco and they took my appointment away, and I still have all these clients. I can move them to a different company. I can't do that as a captive agent. That is the big difference. I've developed the loyalty for the people that are going to come from Belmont.
I just wanted to add to that a little bit. Most of your independent agents probably have 8 or 10 insurance companies that they deal with. So if they lose one, it's no big deal to them. They just channel policies into another insurance company. Completely different situation.
And once again, guys, I appreciate you coming down here today. Thank you very much, John.
All righty then. I'm going to call Lana Butterfield, Ron Manza, and Roger Beyer.
Sure.
Yes, sir. Okay. Just give it to Tamsin, please. Thank you very much. There's a bunch of protocol here we have to follow. And then I'm going to follow up with Elizabeth O'Carey, Brian Miller, and John Powell. Go ahead, whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here on behalf of the professional insurance agents of Oregon, Idaho. We're a different kind of agent than the one that you've heard from just before. And I've brought with me Ron Manza, who is the legislative chair for PIA. I'm going to let him address you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ron Manza. I'm currently employed with Fullerton Insurance, a company or an agency in Portland. Prior to that, I was an employee and an owner of an independent insurance agency, Stewart & Tuno Insurance, for 39 years. Independent agents, now called producers, are different from captive and direct writer insurance producers. Independent agents sell for more than one insurance company. We own the rights to the renewals of the policies that we sell. We do not sign non-compete agreements with their appointed insurance companies. And we do not look to insurance carriers to fund our retirements. We are asking for the Dash 1 Amendment because the definition of captive, as originally drafted, it inadvertently catches new independent agents who are just starting out with their very first appointment with an insurance carrier. We believe that this was unintended and it could be harmful to new independent agents, making it more difficult to get appointed in the first place with no track record. Under the Dash 1 Amendment, definition of captive agent would read, a captive agent means that an insurance producer who derives at least 80% of their gross income from a single insurer and the insurer's affiliated companies and is obligated by contract to direct all qualifying business to that primary insurer. This clarifies that independent insurance agents would not be affected by this bill because contracts signed by independent producers do not contain such obligations, even if the majority of their income is derived from a single insurer. With this amendment, PIA can be neutral on this bill. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions.
Mr. Beyer, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here representing the Independent Agents and Brokers of Oregon, another association of independent agents. I would agree with the testimony just given that if the Dash 1 amendments are adopted into this bill, the independent agents and brokers would be neutral on the bill. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of these folks?
Mr. Chair, just please a comment that I appreciate the cooperation I've received on drafting Dash 1 amendments, and I would anticipate they would be in the bill. There was never any intention to capture independent agents. They're remarkably different from captive agents.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions in this panel?
Thank you very much.
All right. Elizabeth O'Carey, I hope I'm saying that right, Elizabeth. Forgive me. Brian Miller and John Powell, please.
And that's all I have on the list. If anyone else wants to testify on this bill, let me know before we close the public hearing. Whoever wants to go first, please go ahead.
Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Chairman Schaffler. Elizabeth Mulseri. I'm the regional counsel for Allstate Insurance Company. I'm the director of government relations for Oregon. I'm based in Seattle. I would like to offer some brief comments in opposition to HB 3. I have to put my glasses on.
3374.
We have captive agents, and they are independent contractors with Allstate. We do terminate agents on occasion. Our termination numbers are very, very small, less than 1%. I would say that the agents that do get terminated are the worst of the worst. We work really hard with our independent agents, our independent contractors, to make sure that they are adhering to our company standards and our agency contract. If this bill did pass, only the worst of the worst would be allowed to stay after 10 years. They would be the bad apples. We've got a lot of concerns about damage to our brand and to our customers. For example, an agent could use racial comments. They could open up their agency office next to a massage parlor and be nothing we could do. We do have customer service standards, which are very important to us. As you know, insurance is a very competitive industry, and it's very important for us that our customers are treated correctly. And if an agent does not treat our customers correctly, we do want to have the opportunity to talk with them, to improve their service, and to have the ability to eventually terminate them. But there are very, very small numbers. The process is very, very fair. We have a peer review process and corporate security investigations. I can't speak to the experience of other agents with other companies, but I know our own experience is that we are dealing with the worst of the worst. The other concern we have is that it would put the companies who do have captive agents in a competitive disadvantage. GEICO, USAA, some Progressive Direct, a lot of companies are going towards direct with call centers, and we would have concerns that it would put us as a competitive disadvantage, that we would be allowed, forced to have agents who mistreat our customers, and then those customers would leave our company and go with another company. Thank you.
Great. Chair Schaffler and members of the House Business Insurance Committee. For the record, my name is Brian Miller, here today representing Farmers Insurance Group. I appear before you in opposition to House Bill 3374. It is Farmers' opinion that passage of House Bill 3374 would be detrimental to the future success of insurers utilizing exclusive agents and to many exclusive agents themselves. Most importantly, we conclude that House Bill 3374 is not in the best interest of insurance consumers. With regard to exclusive agents that have at least 10 years of history representing their insurance company, it is our estimation that passage of House Bill 3374 would have the following impacts. First, absent an agent committing a crime, the insurer would have no recourse to deal with an agent having any number of unacceptable or inappropriate business practices. Secondly, there would be no insurer remedy for agents who habitually mistreat customers or provide poor customer service. In our highly competitive and service-focused industry, and given how customers' perspectives on a company's reputation and brand can quickly be altered, this legislation would eliminate any remedy for the proverbial bad apple agent. Third, agents would not be subject to any kind of performance standard. This problem would manifest itself in a number of ways. Poor field underwriting and improper classification of risk in a single large agency can alter the cost of insurance for entire rating territories. This would negatively affect the rates that other agents in this territory could then market and sell, and would inequitably increase the cost of insurance for customers in that area. Agents not offering a company's full suite of products do a disservice to customers by not attempting to identify and adequately protect all insurable interests that a customer may have. And this, of course, can include autos, their home, rental properties, boats, life insurance, and retirement planning, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, agents could retire in their agencies rather than retire from their agencies. And for a growth company like Farmers in an ultra-competitive environment, having any number of individuals in that particular capacity would be detrimental, certainly, to our business results. There are a few other points that I should make. Farmers Insurance is not in the business of getting rid of agents. In fact, quite the opposite is true as we look to profitably increase our footprint here in Oregon. Over the last 6 years, 2003 through 2008, we have appointed 453 new agents in Oregon while initiating the termination of 54 agents. Of those 54, only 11 of these have been with Farmers for more than 10 years. So again, of the company-initiated terminations, only 11 over the last 6 years have been for agents that have been with Farmers for more than 10 years. As an aside, while our agent contract stipulates that any party can end our business arrangement for no reason with 90 days' notice, ORS 744-081, which you've heard referenced previously, does require an insurer to state the specific reasons for the termination. Agents we do happen to part ways with, whether by company request or not, do not walk away empty-handed. They receive, in the farmer's vernacular, what's referred to as a contract value payment that takes into consideration the number of policies in that agency, the tenure of that agent, It also has a component that evaluates the profitability of that agent over a period of time and can pay them up to twice or 200% of their annual commission amount. I would add, too, I think Representative Kinnaman made a comment about, it was Mr. Massengill, that Farmers is very upfront when we meet with new agents in the beginning that this contract value is not designed to be a retirement program. It's the quid pro quo that goes along with having a non-compete clause. So in exchange for an individual, once they leave Farmers, not contacting Farmers customers, they receive that contract value payment. In conclusion, I would respectfully ask the committee to vote no on House Bill 3374 and not create a situation where no check and balance would exist between an insurance company and and its exclusive agency force while they provide these essential services to the general public. Of course, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. State Farm operates under a system of captive agents that you've heard about this morning. Agent termination is taken so seriously by State Farm insurance companies that every termination must be reviewed by and approved by the CEO and president of the company, Ed Rust. This is, as somebody who's worked as an insurance agent, I started an independent insurance agency and worked in that business for 6 years while trying to earn a living and be a legislator. It almost worked, not quite. It's a good living. It's a good way to make a living. It's fun. You get up in the morning, you get to meet a lot of good people, you get to help them, and at very serious times in their lives, many times you deliver a check to help them out. So it's a good life. And quite frankly, had I stayed in the insurance business, I would have sought a State Farm agency appointment. And the reason I would have done that is for all of the ancillary benefits to being a captive agent, and primarily training is probably the most important single element. As an independent agency and agent, I found it difficult to get training on the specifics of the policies that I was writing for different companies, and that took a lot of effort on my part without the benefit of a company that treats and trains their agents like State Farm, which has a tremendous value. A captive agent has rights under existing law in Oregon. In fact, the statute before you, as Mr. Miller has pointed out on line 16, has this sentence in it: the notice must specify the reasons for termination. And the statute goes on to say that termination shall be without prejudice to the contract rights of the insurance producer so terminated. That, in essence, means they have continued rights in terms of the judicial branch. An agent can sue for breach of contract, breach of implied covenants of good faith and fair dealing, torturous business interference, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and other things. In other words, remedies for unfounded business practices already exist. And again, in the case of State Farm, that's why it goes to the very top when a termination takes place. I think the point that was made by the chair earlier, why would a company or the legislature deem it necessary to give this kind of an employment right to an independent contractor when it wouldn't apply to a long-time State Farm employee? And I think that's a question that's just impossible to answer in an appropriate way. Why would this apply to insurance and not the supplier of beverages to a restaurant that has depended on one chain for the development of a large segment of their business? Why wouldn't they then, after 10 years, get this kind of a right? So, Mr. Chairman, I'm 61 years old. I don't like to work 12-hour days. but I don't expect those that employ me to continue my contracts if I don't produce. And maybe the bill should be amended to lobbyists who have served more than 10 years. And yeah, you could narrow it to not include me by saying those that just have one employer. If I was the lobbyist for Northwest Natural Gas after 10 years, why wouldn't I get the same kind of termination rights that are pointed out in this bill? Mr. Chairman, there's many more things I could say, but I'll stop at that point. Thank you.
Well, before I open to questions, I believe that 30 years ago, someone may well and probably did tell these gentlemen that you work for 5 or 10 years, you just get money from there on. I believe it. But they didn't get it in writing, and that's the problem. And I do have something in writing here. And Brian, it's directed right at you. You're the bad guy to these guys right here. No, we're not telling you anything. It's on the contract that Mr. Starr gave us. And it's the heading is contract value. Contract value is based upon, one, the amount of service commissions paid to the agent on active policies during either the 6-month or 12-month period immediately preceding termination, the number of policies in the agent's active code number, the number of years continuous service as an agent for the companies immediately prior to termination. I guess I need to get a better understanding of exactly, I mean, if what it means to be inactive or not pursuing, and how you actually justify termination and how you prove that there's evidence that that's not going on. If you could try and explain to me how you know that's not happening.
Sure, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, we apply the same criteria to any agent, frankly, regardless of how long they've been with Farmers or what their stature is in terms of their production. But the things that we would look at would be sales production, whether or not that agency is growing in size and the number of policies and the number of customers or not, whether that agency is profitable, and that's measured by the amount of premiums that agency takes in versus the amount of claims and losses and dollars it pays out. And finally, we would evaluate the customer service, and that can be done in a variety of ways, but most notably is the number of complaints that the insurance division or that Farmers might receive. Generally speaking, those are the types of things that our field management team would look at when they're evaluating any agent.
Okay, and then, these are interesting statistics, but there is one more question, and be careful how you answer it. Do you or does anyone in this room know of any threats to this man right here as a result of his testifying here today, as any threats of him being terminated as an agent? Do you know of any threats like that? Anybody?
Chair Schaffler, I certainly do not.
Anyone else? That's good. Any further questions of these good people? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powell, question. You talked about the notice requirement given when a captive agent is terminated under 744. I don't think that there's any issue that notice is given. I guess the question is, what if that notice is essentially pretextual in nature for essentially other economic factors? Is that actionable right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I'm not sure I understand are you saying it's just a general statement that says, you're not performing?
For example, let's assume that Farmers, for example,
actionable.
Were to give notice, and the basis of that would be essentially a pretext.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, it would be actionable, and it would be a question of what is the implied good faith and dealings in this in the contractual language versus the statement.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Barton, if I may just add to that, to clarify for the record, the example that Mr. Starr shared with the committee is in fact correct. Farmers did make, both in 2001 or late in 2000, and again with Mr. Starr's situation, a clerical error with the language in the letter we sent to him. We were in fact fined by the insurance division back in 2001, and I'm aware of no such action this time around, but as soon as we were made aware of that error, we corrected it and sent Mr. Starr a letter, but that we in fact did make a mistake and with regard to how we communicated to him in this particular case.
I would recommend that you be far more diligent in your future correspondence with these people. I'm just a laborer, but I think lack of diligence, words mean a lot.
Representative Witt, Ben Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Mr. Miller. I'm wondering how Farmers establishes its quota for a book of business.
Representative Shoffler, Chair Shoffler, Representative Witt, we do not establish quotas for tenured or existing agents.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Please.
We had testimony a short while ago that if one of the agents increased his business by 300%, I think was the figure that he used, that he might not be terminated. That sounds to me like it's getting close to establishing a quota.
Chair Shoffler, Representative Witt, I can't speak to that particular comment that you heard in testimony. I can only state that as a general approach, we apply the criteria that I shared beforehand, where we want to see agencies growing, where we want to see them producing and selling policies. There are no specific numbers associated with that.
Thank you.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Chair Shoffler and Mr. Miller. I guess there's a couple parts of the testimony, and I'm learning like everybody else on this issue, but a couple parts of your testimony, and I think being an individual that has Farmers Insurance, I'll first say that when you say that this bill is not in the best interest of insurance consumers, I can tell you that with my policy changing, and I will get to the bottom of it, I've got somebody that I've been with for over a dozen years, and now all of a sudden I've had three agents in the last 9 months calling with my policies, and I've got several of them. That's not in the best interest of the consumer. I'll find out why that is. I guess my question would be, you say there's no, specifically, there would be no insurer remedy for agents who habitually mistreat customers or provide poor customer service. Don't take me for a fool, please, and I don't think that's your intention, but I will change agents. I will change insurance if that were to occur. There is change that occurs, and it's called choice. So specifically, I do have a question, and that is that your specific numbers have appointed 453 new agents in Oregon while initiating termination of 54. How many retirements have you had over this time frame?
Chair Shoffler, Representative Matthews, I do not know how many retirements we've had over that period of time. Those would not have been included as company initiated, but that's certainly a number I could get for you if you like.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Please, go right ahead.
Just for the record, and I'm sure that we're going to get to that, but there's a letter on file, and I happen to feel like it's probably happening frequently, but that is that there's an older generation out there that feels like they are being forced into retirement for these new agents to come in at a little bit lesser degree. So I would say that only 11 of these have been with Farmers for more than 10 years. We have about 33% of those people sitting in this audience today. Those are pretty high numbers. I wouldn't expect you to comment on that because of potential litigation, but I would like to know how many retirements have happened in the same time frame. If you can get that to the committee, that would be great. Thank you.
Chair Shoffler, Representative Matthews, I can certainly do that. If I could make one comment on your your initial point, my comment was specific to an insurance company remedy. You were certainly correct that somebody feels mistreated or not satisfied with the relationship they have with an insurance agent, they can switch insurance agents, and in fact, likely will switch insurance companies as well. My reference was to the insurance company's ability.
Thank you. Clarifying. Thank you.
Representative Barton and Ketimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on actually Representative Matthews' comments on the remarkable statistic that a full third of the Farmers agents in question happen to be with us. In another coincidence, another third apparently live in my district and were not able to attend today, but I have received constituent emails from three or four agents, Farmers agents in my district who claim to, perhaps they have not yet been terminated, but claim to fall in this class and claim to have this hanging over their heads.
Mr. Chairman, are referring to a third of the 11. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes.
Representative Kennemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess another point, and I appreciated Representative Matthews' line of questioning and Representative Barton. I know of a number of agents who, in this process, and I will call it intimidation because that's how I see it, have the pot sweetened a trifle to voluntarily resign rather than get terminated. So I think there is a logical explanation for the low numbers. The other thing that I'd like to point out, just as a last point, is it was pointed out on line 16 that the notice must specify the reasons. That's what the law says, and, you know, when you look, if you're the least bit creative, there are a lot of reasons. It's not limited to the ones that follow. So it could be that it's Monday morning. It could be company policy. It could be that space aliens may exist. It doesn't really matter what the reason is. You have to simply state a reason, and that's what the law requires. And frankly, I have several instances, and I see head nodding against that, but I have several instances where people have been told that they would not get a reason other than the company had decided. And that's not an answer. That's just a statement.
I would be interested to see what kind of response that, if they went to court, how a judge would interpret that reason and that, whether or not that fell within the reasonable limits of the law. I'm not a judge, but I think maybe my counselor here may have a comment on it.
And I'd be intrigued to hear what Mr. Powell has, Mr. Chair.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I know it's not appropriate to ask committee members questions, but I was begging Representative Barton to say, bring the case to me. I do think if somebody is, that is exactly the kind of action that would end up in court. And that's exactly why the CEO and president of one of the largest insurers in the world reviews and has to agree with every single one of these. And by doing so, obviously puts him in that chain to be called. The point's been made that it's cheaper to get rid of an agent. If you get rid of a good, solid producing agent that's been with you a long time and replace them with a rookie, you've got to train them. You've got to make sure they understand company policy. It takes a long time to get them there, and it's expensive. It is not cheap to just go get a new insurance agent and put them out there selling insurance. They need more support, and it's an expensive proposition.
And I would also, you know, employees are employed today at will in Oregon, especially those that aren't protected under a labor contract. At will. I can go up right now, tell Mr. Harold he's fired because I have a headache. I would never do that because he's the best legislative assistant in the state of Oregon. But I could, and that would be a stupid thing to do, just like I believe you would be a stupid thing to do with a producing agent. Representative Barton, then Witt. Escobar, then Witt. My peripheral vision is
I'm not that
getting worse and worse.
Mr. Chair. A couple things. One is that, John, if you had worked for State Farm, which is a different company, and you were 61 years old and you'd worked there since you were 20, how would you feel about that?
Mr.
Being
Chairman.
Put out to pasture and having your clientele taken away from you, but more importantly, having it turned over to someone at a lesser degree where the company was definitely making a profit. How would you feel about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, that's the same issue with any full-time employee of State Farm. If you were a full-time employee and I was an independent contractor, you were let go and they hired somebody at a lower salary, it'd be exactly the same thing. If I was a State Farm agent today, I'd have approximately 2,500 customers, not 1,500 customers, and I would be producing. And if new products came on the market, like long-term care, I would learn those products and I would market those products. I wouldn't say, I just don't feel like doing that. And if I didn't feel like doing that, I wouldn't expect that company to keep me as an agent.
But I might add before you follow up, we don't have the benefit of why anybody's been terminated. And I think I would be reluctant if I were contracting with someone to publicly state why I terminated them for fear of it could be brought up in litigation. Representative Esquivel, please.
Yes, and why then does companies not have, and I'm relating this kind of what I do, because I'm an independent contractor as well. But why don't you have an inactivated status to where an individual can take care of their clientele if they so choose and still maintain that clientele, still take care of it with no repercussions to the customer or the client?
Mr. Chair and Representative Esquivel, I think there are a lot of agents in their later years of working have a systematic way of taking care of their business and perhaps working with another agent or somebody in their office who is licensed to do just about what you said. That is, they're not there all the time. They're not the one doing all the soliciting, and they have other people in their offices doing that. So, in essence, there are models that can have people slow down, if you will.
Okay, follow up.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Well, then, why do we just terminate people then? Why don't we lead the horse to water and give them an opportunity to drink and suggest that they do so instead of just terminating them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, I've tried to make the testimony clear. We do not terminate people just to terminate people. We don't, you know, you're handicapped in this forum in that you can only get one side of a story. The number of terminations is very, very small. And if you compared it to the independent agency force, I would imagine that it's higher in the independent agency force because they have multiple contracts and there are changes going on all the time. So this issue, while it sounds great big in this room right now, is not an issue that affects very many insurance agents.
Absolutely, Representative Esquivel. I'm going to give you one last follow-up, then we're going to Representative Witt, then we're moving on.
Well, then, I'm going to ask two questions, then.
get them while you can, Representative.
One is, you do not represent farmers. You represent state farms. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, that's correct.
Okay. So, but it seems like farmers is the problem child here. Now, what you remind me of, your company reminds me of a bad broker. And what I mean by that is I have had occasions to where I work for a broker, the listings belong to the broker. If you leave, the listings stay with that broker, period. And sometimes when you're away, they end up not only with the broker, but so does your clients. That's kind of on the same line. And that's disturbing to me, sir.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Esquivel, thank you for the opportunity. I do want to address something John said, and Farmers Insurance takes terminations of agents equally seriously, and we do, in fact, for an agent that we feel isn't performing up to par, work with them. Our field management works with them on a formal six-month program to help them, in a sense, rehabilitate their agency. If that is unsuccessful or if the agent isn't willing to do so, it's at that point that we move forward with their termination.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned, like you are, Mr. Chairman, that we not be abrogating at-will employment here, on the one hand. But on the other, with the benefit of only a third of the universe present as witnesses here, I am seeing a trend. Some middle-aged males, and I'm not seeing a lot of other demographics represented with the folks who have problems. So that would be the countervailing force here to at will. This is not a trend, although only a third of the universe, not a trend that I'm terribly comfortable with.
All right, I'm a generous man. I'm going to allow one more question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been very quiet, so.
You most certainly have, Representative. And don't think it's lost on me that you have been.
Okay. Well, I'm just not really clear here. Are these captive agents, are they independent contractors, or are they employees? Because we keep talking about this at-will employment, which would apply to employees, it seems like. So I'm a little confused. It seems like it's mixed up.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Thatcher, they are independent contractors.
Okay, then.
All right, thank you very much. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill today, on House Bill 3374?
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Representative. It is a very interesting conversation. I think the insurance company has learned something from it. and I'm fairly confident they will be more diligent in their correspondence and be hypersensitive to this issue from here on out, because there's always next session, and this goes for every single insurer out there. And if we do see a trend, and it's blatantly obvious, I mean, we have the University of 11 here, so I don't think it really merits a radical trend at this point. But if it does, we'll be back here. So I think our good friends in the insurance companies get exactly what I'm saying. With that, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3374. And all right. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2457.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard House Bill 2457 on March 13th. The original measure allows the State Plumbing Board to authorize a journeyman plumber who obtains training and certification from a board-recognized provider to design fire sprinkler systems in one- and two-family story dwellings. You have in front of you a dash two amendment, which was discussed at the first hearing. The amendment replaces the bill, allows the journeyman plumber licensee to design the plumbing portion of a fire sprinkler system for installation in either a residential structure that is subject to the low-rise residential dwelling code or to a residential structure of any type.
Ron Murray, please. Go ahead, Ron, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters. The Dash 2 Amendment is the language that was agreed to by the engineering community. And for expedience, unless you want me to, I won't go through my previous testimony.
That's okay, Ron. We did hear it, I remember.
Okay, thank you.
If there's questions, we're going to get to it.
And the Dash 2 Amendment last Thursday was also endorsed by the Oregon Fire Service Legislative Committee.
And then,
so we think that this basically brings us into line with the other provisions in the Building Code Division, and also brings Oregon in line with the national standards for installation of residential fire sprinklers. It's basically, this is current practice. So.
Any questions of Mr. Murray? We do not have all the paperwork to work this bill today. The chair is sympathetic to it. I know there's some good people that have issues with it. I've expressed my concern that it not bleed into a point where plumbers are engineering huge buildings. But I believe we did do something similar to this for electricians a couple
correct.
Years ago, and we have the building codes. I don't think that's turned into the end of the world yet. But any questions of Mr. Murray? And we're not going to work the bill today, so we'll have two people testifying against it in a moment. Okay, thanks, Ron.
Thank you, sir.
Dan Linscheid and Mary Lopez, please. Can we have an amendment taken out of the engineering code?
Yes, that's correct.
And just so you good folks know, I understand the concerns, but we do have an amendment taking this language out of the engineering code. Which I know was expressed earlier, and I don't know if you have the benefit of that knowledge. But go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler, committee members. Dan Linscheid with the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineers and Land Surveyors. We've looked at the Dash 2, and we still have concerns that, number one, this expands this to a three-story multifamily structure. We're kind of wondering what's next. Could it be apartments and go on to bigger and better? I'm also concerned with, it looks like there was an attempt in the Dash 2 to remove the language that talked about the rulemaking authority of the State Plumbing Board, but it's still there. This still falls under their rulemaking authority, whether or not it's in the bill. With that, I will go ahead and ask Mari if she would like to testify, but if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
We'll open them up as soon as...
Good morning, Chair Representative Schaffler. My name is Mari Lopez. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying, and Mr. Linscheid has pretty well summed it up. I'm here just, you know, happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Any questions of these good people today?
because we're probably, when we get the paperwork, we'll just work the bill, and if there's the votes, it'll pass it out. So now's your chance, and I, Representative Thatcher.
I don't know how to put this in a kind way, so please excuse me if this sounds brusque. Is this a turf issue?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Thatcher, I don't really think so. What we saw, as Chair Schaffler said a few moments ago, we saw last time with the electrical, with the electricians, we saw this expanding into so that the, at least in our board's perspective, the public is not receiving the protection they historically have. And it's eroding away from that protection that these people are trained, they have the experience and all the qualifications required to do a holistic review of these systems as they integrate. And our concern as a board is that that kind of holistic review and make sure that we have that integration across all these systems instead of just focusing on one is very critical. I wouldn't call it a turf issue. Thank you.
I would call it a scope of practice issue, though. That, I think, is a kinder word.
Thank
that
you,
being
sure.
Said, I mean, I believe plumbers are qualified to rig these systems up. If they were going to go in the coin tower, I think I would be more sympathetic to your cause. But and believe me, I do no way, shape, or form want to in any way think that I think any ill against the engineers of this great state. So, because you're doing a great job. Any further questions of these good people? All right, thank you very much. Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 2457 today? Once again, we're not working it. When we get paperwork, we will. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2457, and I'm going to skip around a little bit, go to one where we do have the paperwork for it, to open a public hearing on House Bill 2907.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2907 prohibits a contracting agency from entering into an agreement with another state in which the contracting agency agrees that the contractor may pay less than the prevailing wage rate under the terms of the public work contract. There is an emergency clause in the measure effective upon passage.
And do we have...
Mr. Chair, can we be at ease for a moment? We need
yes,
to get Mr. Chair, Representative.
Very
He's
good.
Just walked in.
Okay. Representative Holy, would like to testify on behalf of the bill?
Yeah.
Your bill. Make sure Tamsin turns the mic back.
And we need are we on again, Tamsin?
We are on.
Any reserve tie-up sheet?
No.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. For the record, Paul Holby, State Representative, District 8.
I brought
this bill forward. It is a pretty obscure bill without a lot of probably fanfare around it. But it came to my attention last year that ODOT enters into interstate agreements to perform public works projects from time to time with other states, and sometimes they're totally involved with federal Davis-Bacon wages, and we don't supersede those agreements. But when there are state monies involved, there is an instance, and was an instance, where one of these interstate agreements was with Idaho and would actually have paid workers less than the Oregon prevailing rate of wage inside the boundaries of Oregon, on the Oregon side of the bridge, essentially. And our current statutes actually allow that to happen. And so this bill is basically designed to say, no, the state cannot enter into agreements like that pay workers less than the prevailing weight of wage for Oregon. That's essentially it. Pretty short, pretty simple. Doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it actually, especially with the case of Idaho, where the wages are several dollars different, would make it much harder for Oregonians to work on those projects inside the boundaries of Oregon. That's the essence of the bill. Pretty narrow focus, and probably doesn't happen but once in a blue moon. But there you have it.
Thank you, Representative, and it enjoys the chair's full support. And if we have votes today, we're going to work it out as committee. Any questions of Representative Holvey? We've done a fine job, Representative. Thank you very much. Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 2907 today? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2907. I'm going to work session on House Bill 2907.
I've had a lot of offers.
I'll entertain a motion.
Representative Holvey.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2907 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holvey moves House Bill 2907 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Do I see any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Holvey, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
Certainly.
All right, I'm closing work session on House Bill 2907 and go back to the regular order of things and open a public hearing on House Bill 2705.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2705 modifies the circumstances that require an insurer or a self-insured employer to contact an injured worker for evaluation of eligibility for vocational assistance. You have in front of you a -1 amendment, which restores deleted language that outlines the worker's conditions to receive notice. Both the -1 amendment and the original bill were approved by MLAC at their meeting on April 3rd.
And unfortunately, we do not have the required paperwork to work the bill today, but I'm going to call Mr. Hagedorn and Ms. Levier. Did I say that, Labier? Oh, thank you very much. I'm doing my best. Whoever wants to go first, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Drew Hagedorn on behalf of the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. The OSIA, as you may know, is an association of large private and public employers that self-insure for workers' compensation purposes. They have House Bill 2705 before you today. As your administrator mentioned, this comes to you with unanimous MLAC support. It relates to vocational eligibility evaluations and comes with the -1 amendment, which also was approved by MLAC. I'm going to turn now to Susan LaViere, the co-chair of our legislative committee, and she's our subject matter expert on this issue. She's going to describe the public policy issues addressed by the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Susan LaViere, and I am coming today to speak about the vocational eligibility requirements bill. This came to our attention through an audit that the department had completed of insurers and self-insured employers, and out of that audit it was determined that the industry interpretation of the statute was different than what the statute actually provided. The statute provides that eligibility determinations or eligibility workers are eligible for vocational eligibility services if they have a regular work release. If they have regular work release, they're not eligible for vocational services. But that same requirement indicated that a voc eligibility evaluation was required to be completed even if the worker had a regular work release but had not returned to the job and injury. And it didn't take into consideration whether the worker moved, retired, had died in one case, just different issues. So we're trying to, with this bill, bring them both in line with each other. If a worker has a regular work release, then a vocational eligibility evaluation does not have to be completed. But that being said, we want to make sure that we have, and we've discussed this with MLAC, have the ability to inform workers that they do have a right to request a voc eligibility evaluation if they think that their regular work release is not correct. And we're working with the department to develop language on some of the administrative forms to inform the workers of that right.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, that's the document that we distributed to all of you. We committed to MLAC that we'd share the notice that we recommend, and we'll work with them and other stakeholders through the administrative rule process to make sure that workers get the notice they deserve. I agree with what Representative Schaffler said on a prior bill, words matter, and that's why we made that effort to put that together to illustrate the direction we think we're headed.
And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2707 as well. Go right ahead and testify to that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Drew Hagedorn again for OSIA in support of 2707. There's a -2 amendment to this bill. It relates to instances where injured workers have more than one job. It's the law of supplemental disability benefits. The -2 amendment has yet to be approved by MLAC. We anticipate that will take place on Friday of this week, so that's why it's scheduled only for a public hearing today. I'll turn again to our subject matter expert, Susan LaViere.
Yes, the issue that came about with regarding the processing of supplemental disability benefits, it was determined that some workers were actually earning more after they were injured than previously. And the intent of supplemental disability is to make workers whole. And so what we're trying to address at this point is for workers who actually, upon being injured, do receive additional benefits than they were doing prior to their injury, and therefore it's very difficult to get these workers motivated to return back to work. And as well as this bill will address some timelines for workers to provide that information so that would ensure it can actually implement the benefits in a timely manner.
Thank you. As I said, the first one, we're simply waiting for paperwork, and it was, Drew pointed out, the second one is going to be heard at MLAC on Friday. Yes. And then when we get all that back, we'll be working. I love the MLAC process. It's been well vetted, and the other one will be well vetted, and makes me feel comfortable. Any questions of these good people before we let them go? Representative Witt, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just am interested in the specific circumstances where an injured worker would be receiving more income from potentially two jobs than they would be under a claim than they would be if they were at work.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, what happened, what currently the common way this occurs is that one thing that was not discussed prior to implementation of supplemental disability benefits is volunteers. Volunteers do receive an assumed wage, and so once they're injured, upon the implementation of supplemental disability benefits, they get reimbursed 100% for their other wages, or 66 2/3, but they do get reimbursed for their regular income, but they also receive an assumed wage as well.
Mr. Chair?
Okay. Are you finished, Representative Witt?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I can't hear her very well.
Oh, miss, I'm sorry. You got to yell in that microphone.
Sorry. It was for volunteers. Workers receive an assumed wage. So if a worker is being reimbursed for 100% of their, I misspoke, 66 2/3 of their wages that they received at their secondary employment, so they're basically reimbursed for those wages, but they're also receiving an assumed wage for volunteering. So previous to the supplemental disability benefits, they just would receive only the assumed wage.
Everyone clear on that? Any further questions of these good people? I'm sorry, Rep. Sam Thatcher. I have you written down right here. Forgive me.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify the supplemental temporary disability benefits. Is that a separately purchased policy, or is that something that's available through the workers' compensation carrier or self-insured group?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, actually, that is a benefit that is actually reimbursed from the worker benefit fund.
Okay.
So it actually is either administrated by the insurer and then reimbursed, or actually you can opt to have the department administer those benefits.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Any further questions? Once again, when we get everything back, we'll work these out. Thank you very much. Any further comment?
No. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Would anyone else like to testify on behalf of House Bill 2705 or House Bill 2707? Just for the record, we have SAFE and workers' comp and a bunch of other concerned folks, so I think these are pretty straightforward bills. We'll be returning to them. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2705 and 2707. Anything for the good of the order? All right, we're adjourned.